Bromley and Jeff Sargent.
Good evening. Coming up on the program, a well-respected SFU professor is presumed to be drowned after a kayaking accident off the coast of Washington.
And tickets for some 2010 Olympic events are already on sale, but not without a hefty price tag.
And on commentary this week, Phil Caudry discusses the recent by-election results in Quebec.
We'll have all this plus arts, sports, and your weekend weather forecast coming up in the next hour right here on News 101. Now, in this week's UBC feature, News 101 reporter Rita Farkas gets an in-depth look at students protesting against the University Square development.
Can you just tell me, first of all, where we are?
All right, and We're joined with Rita Farkas here now. So, Rita, tell us a little bit about what you've got for us here.
Thanks, Jeff. Last week, on Friday, I went out and had a word with a few of the UBC students who are at the demonstration. This has been set up from the beginning of classes last week, and they have a problem with a development that's in proposal. So here's what a couple of them had to say.
What are your biggest concerns?
Well, there's a lot of different ways to look at what's going on in this area. I mean, personally for me, my major concern is sort of the ongoing privatization of the campus in particular. I mean, as it stands right now, there's 4 Starbucks on campus, plus another one in the Village. There's Tim Hortons. There's a lot of kind of corporate endeavors taking place on campus. The retail space that would be planned would be at market costs for the area, so the kinds of businesses that would be able to afford those rents would be businesses that would be in direct competition to the AMS. So that would kind of take a lot of the revenue away from students on campus and deposit it in unknown hands elsewhere. One of the things, when this plan was announced back in April that the decision would be made by the Board of Governors in May, there was so much student opposition to it right from the get-go. There was a petition that went around. We were able to collect about 3,000 signatures just right off the bat. The decision-making process has been a little questionable in some ways because the Board of Governors, as it stands right now, there are 7 elected representatives on it. 3 of them are representatives of the UBC students. All of those representatives, from the students at least, were against, like, unanimously opposed to this kind of development. However, they are outnumbered by the rest of the appointed Board of Governors. And other than Stephen Toop and the Chancellor and the elected representatives, they are without fail real estate developers.
Mm-hmm. What would you say to people who look at the project and go, yeah, that's unfortunate, but I'm only here for 4 years, so why should I care?
Well, that's kind of one of the things that we're addressing with this park and with this project as well, too, that overall, there seems to be this sort of sense of disempowerment among the student community, that mm-hmm. decisions are being made and people who speak up are literally pushed down. We're kind of saying that's why these decisions are being made in a lot of ways, because people are letting their voices go.
Okay, Mike, we're here at the Trek Park. I assume you've spent a fair amount of time out here. Why are you out here?
Well, we're out here because we're concerned about the lack of public space around the city, and especially at the university. It seems to be eroding faster than we can hold on to it, and this proposed tunnel is kind of the last straw as far as this group of students is concerned. Certainly a lack of consultation is the issue that comes to the surface quickest, but I think there's an underlying issue here, and that is the entire structure of this university. Mm-hmm. There's 45,000 students here, a whole ton of faculty and a whole ton of workers for the university, and they have very little representation in any of the decisions that go on here. The Board of Governors is made up of 21 members. It just so happens that 11 of those are appointed by the province. So any kind of decision, the province can say whatever they want to.
I imagine a lot of students would look at the project, the Trek Park project, and say, well, you know, I'm only here for 4 years, so, you know, there's this sort of apathetic attitude towards really putting any effort into saving something, even if they do feel like it's, you know, it's sad that the Knoll gets torn down. So how would you respond to that?
Well, certainly we're only here for a short time, but this battle is happening here. It's happening across the city, and it's happening across the country. I'd say it's happening all across North America. I mean, it's a trend we've been seeing over the past 100 years, an erosion of the commons is what the educated people call it, I guess. But all over the place, there's no public land. Like, if you look at a map of the city of Vancouver, every piece of land is privately owned except for parks and City Hall and city-owned buildings.
Can you just describe what's happening? I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on here.
Yeah, I guess our motto is we invite students to imagine a space with themselves in mind, and people have been doing that. We've got 150 square yards of sod green grass to be laid down, and some cool tents and domes, games, life-size checkered boards, and all kinds of plants, all kinds of neat stuff.
And so what's the response been like from students?
The response has been incredibly supportive from the vast majority of students that stop by, and from a large chunk of faculty too. I've been talking to a lot of faculty members, and they have been incredibly supportive of the project as well.
And the administration, I don't know, I know the RCMP was involved at one point, but how's the administration been?
They've been really supportive as well, which is might seem like kind of a contradiction because it is their project in the end. For the time being, they say that they are supportive of a peaceful protest, mm-hmm. which this is. Problem with the university is it's an overlapping realm of a whole bunch of legal jurisdictions. Like the Musqueam have legitimate land claims here. Part of it is Crown land, university endowment lands. The GVRD has a section here. So there's a lot of overlapping jurisdictions. What we understand is ultimately it's Crown land. So as such, a peaceful protest can stay here until an opposing party obtains a court injunction mm-hmm. to remove the protest. So. Okay.
And that's what those students had to say about the demonstration. As I mentioned, that footage was taken last week, so I'm sure there's been many more adventures taking place at Trek Park. Any decisions on what will be done with the protests are still pending. Katie?
Thanks, Rita. Now with a look at other local news, here are Hannah Kim and Carrie Baptist.
Staff and students at Simon Fraser University are grieving the loss of award-winning statistics professor Wendy Sitter. He is missing and presumed drowned in a kayaking accident earlier this week off the coast of Bellingham, Washington. SFU statistics colleague Tim Swartz says the 46-year-old Sitter was a friend to many and an outstanding academic at the top of his field. Sitter received a coveted statistics award recognizing a statistical scientist's professional accomplishments in research during his first 15 years after earning a doctorate.
Though many British Columbians are happy to see the Canadian dollar on par with the American dollar, those in BC's film industry are less than thrilled. Don Ramsden, business agent for the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, Local 669, says that while U.S. production companies may prefer Canadian crews for their films, the almighty dollar may be the deciding factor for many in the industry when it comes to choosing a location for their next film. Even funding from the provincial government may not ease the problem, as Ramsden says competition from other provinces provides yet another obstacle for BC's Hollywood North. The last time the Canadian dollar was even with the U.S. was in November of 1976.
Internet ticket brokers are already offering tickets to the opening and closing ceremonies of the 2010 Winter Games, even though the tickets haven't been made available by Olympic organizers. TicketCity.com says prices range between a top price of nearly $1,600 the opening ceremonies to a low of $640 for the closing. One page on the website says 36 tickets are available to each event, but on another page it says the tickets aren't available at this time. At least two other websites, meanwhile, urge potential customers to register their interest. Van O.C. says the official ticketing program hasn't been launched, and anyone claiming to have access to games tickets is making that claim falsely.
Workers at four of the largest hotels in Vancouver gave notice yesterday of an imminent strike. Employees at the Four Seasons, Western Bayshore, Hyatt Regency, and Renaissance Vancouver Harborside have threatened a strike over issues of wages, pension plans, and increased benefits. They have rejected an offer given by management giving a 20% wage increase over 5 years, saying that it is not enough. The proposed strike will take effect Saturday at noon.
According to Langley Township Fire Chief Doug Wade, illegal pot growing operations in Vancouver use up to 6% of the power produced by BC Hydro. Wade supports a new resolution before the Surrey Town Council to restrict the sale of hydroponic growing gear to valid electrical permit holders only. Surrey is taking their proposal to the Union of BC Municipalities in hopes of convincing other cities to join in. Surrey Mayor Diane Watts says that the municipalities need to take the lead on the issue. Watts says that passing a resolution to deal with the sale of hydroponic equipment on a city by a city basis is unacceptable. She says that asking the provincial government to examine the issue is a necessity.
Terrasen Gas says natural gas will keep flowing to BC homes and emergency services will be handled, even if one of its unions go on strike. Local 378 of the Canadian Office and Professional Employees Union has resubmitted 72-hour strike notice after the BC Labour Relations Board issued a ruling on essential services. The union, representing 465 employees, has been bargaining with Terrasen since February. The company says it is still willing to resume negotiations.
A new program being introduced in Davie Village hopes to give refuge to people being harassed or discriminated against. The Safe Harbor Project works much like block parent programs, where trained volunteers display a sticker on their windows. Coordinator Lindsay Marsh says participants hope to help those who find themselves the targets of anything from racism to gay bashing. Safe Harbor invites employees from both private businesses and public institutions to attend two-hour training sessions. Participants practice how to respond to different scenarios. LGBT support organization The Center, located on Butte and Davie, is coordinating the program. Education Outreach Coordinator Peter Toppings says overall the project is about diversity as a whole. He adds it's about creating an environment of respect for minorities, seniors, youth, and people with disabilities. The colorful Safe Harbor sticker can already be found on 10 windows in Davie Village. All right, we're going to take a quick break now, but stay tuned to CITR for more news following these public service announcements.
Want to brighten your teeth? We've got a new toothpaste whitener for you.
Oh man, I hate radio commercials.
Well, Sam, you don't have to be a hater anymore, because CITR is not dictated by commercial dollars. Instead, we just play music, sports, spoken word, and news programming that gives listeners what they want.
That's right. We've been running for 25 years on the FM dial as the campus and community radio station. Now we need you, the listeners, to donate towards our funding drive so we can keep bringing you the best local, independent, and rockin' tunes in town.
Your chance to do so is now with our second annual Fun Drive, around the corner. Call into the station in October and help us fund another great year of great music.
Support what you like and what you want to hear.
Donations will go towards renovation of the on-air studio, better production facilities for training and programming, better equipment for remote broadcast, and more.
Tune in from the 1st to the 14th of October to donate.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver. Listener-powered radio.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots global unembedded international independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
This is News 101, and the current time is 5:19. Vancouver and Victoria top the list of Canadian cities offering green urban transportation. The rankings come in the first Green Apple Canada survey, ranking 27 urban areas across Canada. The study was backed by the Appleton Foundation, and spokesperson Barry Appleton says even though two BC cities top the list, they still have progress to make when it comes to environmentally friendly options. St. John's, Newfoundland ranked 27th for failing to follow through on green initiatives. Now, with a look at other BC news, we're joined in studio by News 101 reporters Leanne Yu and Tracy Fuller.
The unexpected resignation of an Anglican minister in Victoria has caused even more hardship to some of the city's neediest residents. The departure of Reverend Antonio Osorio means St. Xavier's Anglican Church can't offer its soup kitchen or shelter. Reverend David Ofine, who has replaced Osorio, says volunteers may be able to revive the soup kitchen, but their 35-bed shelter won't likely open this November. The future of a shelter for immigrant women fleeing abusive relationships is also in question. Osorio resigned September 12th after admitting to what his superiors call substantial sexual misconduct.
The provincial government will pick up the tab for vaccinating girls against the virus responsible for most cervical cancers. Health officials still have to figure out when the vaccinations will be done, which students should get the shot, and even which type of vaccine should be used. But BC Medical Health Officer Dr. Perry Kendall has recommended the vaccine for about 50,000 grade 6 girls starting next year, and that the program become routine thereafter. Health Minister George Abbott says vaccines have shown considerable promise in preventing cervical cancer, which often has no symptoms until it is at a very advanced stage.
The new president of the Union of BC Indian Chiefs is very familiar with the job. Grand Chief Stuart Phillip has been elected to the position for his fourth consecutive three-year term. Phillip, who is also chief of the Penticton Indian Band and chair of the Okanagan National Alliance, says he is honored and humbled by his re-election. He adds he'll continue to work strenuously to unite First Nations and force the federal and provincial governments to fully recognize Aboriginal title.
If you see a team of cyclists zooming along the highway between Kamloops and Vancouver, get out of the way. They're on a tight deadline. The five members of the team H2V left Halifax September 14th and expect to arrive here in Vancouver tomorrow as they try to smash a record for the fastest cycle journey across Canada. The team has been riding in three-hour shifts around the clock and reaches Kamloops this afternoon, putting them on track to break the record by a full day. Members hope to raise $1 million for juvenile diabetes research and so far have pulled in $726,000. We're going to take another break now, but when we come back, we'll update you on national and international news. Stay with us. News 101 will continue right after this.
Now wait a minute. You know you make me wanna
shout, shout, let it all out.
Yo, on Tuesday, October 2nd, 2007, CITR 101.9 FM and the UBC AMS presents That DJ Competition at the Pit. And we want you to spin. So here's the download. It's quite simple. Eight DJs play 15-minute sets each with a minimum of three genres of music to keep the party popping. There are no restrictions on what audio sources or what musical style the DJ chooses to use. DJs must bring their own music and needles and provide their own transportation. The equipment provided will be properly functioning, professional, quality equipment. Interested? Then send your demo to That DJ Competition, CITR Radio, 233-6138 Sub Boulevard, Vancouver, BC, V6T1Z1, along with your full name, emailing address, mailing address, home, cell phone number, your musical style, and audio sources used. MySpace submissions are also accepted. Please send them to thatdjcompetition2007@gmail.com. For more information, please visit our website at www.citr.ca or email thatdjcompetition2007@gmail.com.
Live 23 in the news continues on CITR. A court action launched yesterday by two Canadian environmental organizations urges Canada's federal court to hold the federal government accountable to its original targets for greenhouse gas emission reductions as set out in the Kyoto Protocol. Chris Palliere and Andrew Locan, lawyers on behalf of Eco-Justice Canada and Friends of the Earth Canada, say that emission reduction plan proposed by the Conservatives falls so short of the targets originally set out in Kyoto that it flouts previous legislation. Despite the complicated nature of the Kyoto Protocol and the Conservative government's firm stance that Kyoto targets are unreasonable due to the inaction of the previous Liberal government, Palliere says the case is simply about the Conservatives being accountable to the will of Parliament. A spokesperson on behalf of Environment Minister John Baird said that the department declined to comment on the case. Now with more national news, here are News 101 reporters Rita Farkas and Tracy Fuller.
A study conducted by Statistics Canada is revealing the causes of an international trend known as the feminization of education. The study, titled Why Are Most University Students Women?, finds girls at age 15 already show they are better candidates for university than boys. Girls outperformed boys on standardized tests, school marks, and honor roll status, among other categories. One reason may be parental expectations. According to StatsCan, 60% of boys are expected to get degrees, compared with 70% of girls. University College of the Fraser Valley professor John Martin says the public school system began letting boys down in the 1970s when teaching methods were changed to accommodate the learning style of girls. University of Guelph economist Michael Hoy suggests women are more motivated to go to university because of financial payback upon graduation. In 2003, women with higher education earned $2.73 for every dollar earned by female high school graduates. Men earned $2.13 to the dollar. In 1971, only 32% of university graduates were women. The number rose to 58% by 2005.
Finance Minister Jim Flaherty met with U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson today, a day after our dollar hit parity with the U.S. dollar for the first time in 31 years. Flaherty has been trying to calm fears among manufacturers worried about the high value of the loonie. He says there is an upside for industry because a high dollar makes it easier for Canadian companies to import U.S. technology. Flaherty says the economy is more than just the dollar and that other indicators, such as the commodities market, remain strong. His comments came as the Canadian Labour Congress called on the Bank of Canada to reduce interest rates by 0.5 percentage point to protect manufacturers and exporters.
Perhaps it was a case of bad timing which led to big delays in the investigation of the 1985 Air India bombing. Inquiry Commissioner Justice John Major says it appears the creation of Canada's spy agency less than a year prior to the bombing created confusion over the roles of the RCMP and CSIS with respect to the investigation. The CSIS Act came into effect in July 1984, taking security intelligence gathering away from RCMP control. The Air India bombing happened 11 months later. A former top CSIS official told the Inquiry today that information sharing would have gone more smoothly at the time had the two services still been working as one.
Ontario Premier Dalton McGuinty is making light of his political rivals who went after him in last night's televised leaders' debate. McGuinty has called for a provincial election on October 10th. He says the other party leaders spent too much time attacking him and not enough time putting out their own ideas for voters. He says Conservative leader John Tory and NDP leader Howard Hampton shortchanged themselves last night. McGuinty is also making fun of the other two leaders, referring to them as Hojo.
And in international news this week, we are joined once again by News 101 foreign correspondent Peter Otis. Peter has sent us yet another piece from Copenhagen, this time on the subject of Eurocentrism.
Along with the frigid Nordic air, there was something else that hit me as soon as I landed in Denmark. With my suitcases in tow, I went up to the nearest ATM, but hang on. Instead of euros, I was given these orange bills with knights and lions on the back. And not only that, suddenly I was rich. Just like that, I had 500 of these buggers in my hand. Well, as it turns out, Denmark decided to keep its own currency, the kroner, and opted out of using the euro. So what I got to see within minutes of landing is the phenomena of euroscepticism, a word that is not only hard to spell, but also thrown around quite a bit here in Denmark. The movement itself is not new. Opposition to full integration with the rest of the continent has been around for as long as the EU itself. In 1992, Denmark initially rejected the Treaty of European Union, declining to join the club in the first place. This decision was reached through a referendum, proving that while the pro-European movement had lost only by a narrow margin, still more than half of all Danes were opposed to the EU. In 1993, four exceptions, only applicable to Denmark, were added in the Edinburgh Agreement, and so the Danes finally decided to hop on board. But of course, being in Denmark, such a radical political move was followed by some good old-fashioned rioting where police opened fire on some 1,000 protesters. But that's a whole different story. So why would a country that's so close to the heart of the EU be opposed to it? To find out, I turned to Associate Professor and Jean Monnet Chair at the University of Copenhagen, Dr. Henrik Larsen. As I was told, the relations between Denmark and the rest of Europe had never been particularly cozy to begin with.
I think the sort of profound background of all this is that Europe has never had any particularly positive connotations in Danish political or cultural life. And that's something that you find to the present day.
So how do the Danes view the EU today?
It has a fairly sort of pragmatic, instrumental touch to it. What could we concretely get out of it, rather than a kind of mythical idea about a Europe that's got to be organized for its own sake. So the way the question is asked from the point of view of the state, which is that what is it that the state doesn't deliver? And really, a lot of people don't see a great need for Europe doing more. For many people, it's a question of why should Europe do anything?
Now, hang on. I thought that it was small countries exactly like Denmark for whom joining the EU would be the most beneficial. With a population of just over 5 million people and no commodities such as oil or metals to export, you'd think that the Danes would be singing praises for the creation of the EU. Well, as it turns out, in typical Danish fashion, their support is, shall we say, a little subdued.
So in a sense, the debate has shifted to seeing those basic economic things as a good thing. The question is, should it go further than that?
I think I just heard the word good used in reference to the EU. Now that's a first in Copenhagen. But as to not get too excited, Professor Larsen brought me right back down to earth when I asked him about the future of European integration in Denmark.
But of course, with a skeptical population and the possibility of referenda, Denmark continuing in the European integration process is not a given.
And so there you have it. The EU, it seems, is not nearly as unified an entity as it may appear across the Atlantic Ocean. Still trying to define itself, many citizens are unsure whether the organization's role should increase beyond an economic trade zone. So while the real battles over these issues may be fought by diplomats in the European Parliament, for me, the real battle is just having to exchange these godforsaken kroners every time I decide to travel abroad. For News 101 in Copenhagen, Denmark, this is Peter Otis.
And thanks very much to Peter for sending us that piece all the way from Denmark. Nearly 1,000 Buddhist monks in Myanmar's capital city of Yangon took to the streets for the third day on Wednesday, standing alongside thousands of civilians to protest an increase in fuel prices by that country's military government. The monks have issued a public statement which boycotts the receipt of prayers and donations from the military, calling them violent, mean, cruel, ruthless, pitiless kings, the great thieves who live by stealing from the national treasury. The protests began on August 19th in response to the government's decision to raise fuel prices by as much as 500% in some regions. While the public demonstration was originally driven by students and democracy advocates, many of the original protest organizers have been arrested or forced into hiding, causing the public demonstrations to diminish until now. David Steinberg, an expert on Myanmar from Georgetown University, says the recent involvement of the monks is a significant escalation, showing that political and economic frustration in the country has increased. And it's now time for another break here on News 101, but stay tuned for commentary and much more coming up on the other side.
Tuesday, September 25th at 7 p.m., join the Museum of Anthropology at UBC for an evening of lively conversation with Michael Nicol Yugalanis, the creator of Meddling in the Museum, and explore the shifting boundaries of Haida art in a contemporary world. There are more than 90,000 historic photographs in the archives of the Museum of Anthropology. The collection is worldwide, covers a multitude of subjects, and dates from the early 1900s to the present day.
This exhibit reveals only a tiny portion of this hidden gem, yet hints at the remarkable potential of this collection for scholars, researchers, and visitors. Geographically, the collection includes images from the northwest coast of British Columbia, the southwest United States, South America, and various areas of Asia, Oceania, and Africa. Institutionally, the collection documents the people and events that are instrumental in the history and growth of the museum. For more information, please visit www.moa.ubc.ca.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Welcome back to News 101. It's now time for commentary, and this week, the surprising and resounding loss for the Liberals to an NDP candidate in the Quebec riding of Outremont is reinforcing the belief of critics that Stéphane Dion will struggle immensely in Quebec if an election is called. And as the Conservatives are strengthening their position with another former Bloc Québécois seat, Phil Caudry discusses what Dion and the Liberals must do in Quebec to reverse their waning political fortunes.
By-elections in three Quebec federal ridings took place on Monday. The results sent strong indications about the future political fortunes of all four of Canada's parties. In Saint-Hyacinthe-Bagot, the Bloc scored an easy victory, as predicted by many pundits, where voters felt highly unsatisfied with the Stephen Harper government. However, the other two by-elections were big wins for the Conservatives and NDP, and troubling to say the least for the Liberals in the Bloc. In Outremont, a Liberal stronghold for decades, the NDP's Thomas Mulcair scored a huge upset victory over Stéphane Dion's hand-picked candidate in Jocelyn Couillon. This is only the NDP's second electoral victory in history in La Belle Province, with Phil Edmondson being the first in a 1990 by-election. However, the biggest part of this unlikely story is by how much Mulcair won by, a whopping 20% margin over Couillon. A defeat in Outremont was supposed to be problematic for Dion and the Liberal Party's fortunes in Quebec. However, the race was supposed to be very close, within 500 votes or so, not 20%. These results can be lightly put as catastrophic for Dion. Dion has long been a target of the Quebec media over his stances on the fiscal imbalance and Quebec's nation status. Dion, although from the province, is no favorite son of Quebecers. This message was handed to him at the polls Monday, and should be taken that his political message is not welcome, even in a supposedly safe riding such as Outremont. To make matters worse, the Conservatives picked up a seat that was previously held by the Bloc Québécois. The Conservatives continue their trend from the 2006 election of transforming sovereigntist seats into federalist ones. Overnight, the precarious leadership of the Liberal Party has taken a nosedive. The critics questioning Dion's presence in Quebec have not been silenced. Dion will struggle immensely in Quebec in the next election. Sure, Chrétien secured back-to-back-to-back majority governments for the Liberals, and he also wasn't very popular in Quebec. But he was able to sweep Ontario in a time when the Reform Canadian Alliance was falling on deaf ears in that region. The reincarnation of the Reform Canadian Alliance has made major inroads in Ontario. Coupled with a weak provincial Liberal Party, Dion is unlikely to pull a Chrétien. So, Dion must make up lost ground in Quebec, a feat that seems impossible. In order to do this, the Liberals must de-emphasize the image of Dion as their party leader in the province. Liberals should stick to policies that will resonate with Quebecers, such as universal childcare and ending the Afghan mission. The Liberals should use others in the party to spread this message, who are viewed more positively, such as Justin Trudeau. Yes, Dion has to make appearances in the province and can't be invisible, but he must take a back seat until the Liberal message is received. His job then is to echo this message and hope for the best. Dion will also struggle in the West, but strategically, Liberals have always written off the West anyways. The West should deliver like it did in 2006 for the Liberals, so Dion can focus on Quebec and Ontario. At this point, it will still be tough for the Liberals to win enough seats in the East. The Conservatives are established and have done more than the Liberals have in their 13 years in power to eradicate the separatist threat in Quebec. Many Liberals and BQ members have packed their bags and moved to the Tory camp since the last election. The Tories only caught fire in the province late in the 2006 campaign and were not able to reach their full potential in the province. They will in the next election, as Quebec is their top electoral priority and they have the organization set up this time around. So Dion has a challenge on his hands. Perhaps propping up the Tories' minority government is not a bad idea to buy some time and reconnect with voters. And if you wait long enough, a scandal will emerge in the Tory ranks. It's the nature of politics. It is not if a scandal will happen, but when. The sponsorship scandal ended a seemingly undefeatable Liberal government. Maybe Harper's government will only suffer the same fate in a similar fashion. Regardless, Dion must buy his party some time quickly. For News 101 Commentary, I'm Phil Cottery.
And thanks for that, Phil. And our producer, Megan Turcato, is here now with a look at our oddity of the week. And this week, Megan, you're going to tell us about a rebel-rousing German politician who has an unconventional take on marriage.
Thanks, Jeff. A German politician has her contemporaries in the predominantly Roman Catholic state of Bavaria up in arms over her suggestion to change marriage laws in the state. Gabrielle Pauli, the twice-divorced politician who is running for leadership of the Conservative Christian Social Union Party, is suggesting that marriage should expire after 7 years. At the end of the term, Polly suggests that couples should have the opportunity to either renew their vows or have the union dissolved automatically, leaving them free to look for another partner. Polly's suggestion is causing concern among her Conservative Party colleagues, as well as the Bavarian Roman Catholic clergy, many of whom are calling for her immediate resignation. Indigo Frederick, once such members of the Christian Social Union, says that Pauli is diametrically contradicting the Christian ethical values which the party stands for. This is not the first time that Pauli has caused a stir in Bavarian politics. In January of this year, Polly was photographed in a suggestive pose while wearing elbow-length latex gloves soon after leading to a revolt against CSU chairman and Bavarian premier Edmund Sotber. Sotber recently resigned from his post as premier, and Polly continues to campaign for her cause.
I'm sorry, Megan. I kind of threw you off with my little laugh there. I can see you. But, I don't know. Jeff, what do you think on this? 7 years and then your marriage is done.
It's like a driver's license. That was the first thing that came to mind. It's like, you know, a driver's license, you know, you can expire. It expires. And, you know, if you don't want to renew it, you don't have to. And, you know, you can't drive anymore. But you pay a fee and you're renewed for another 7 years.
Maybe
it's an interesting concept.
Restrictions on your first term of marriage. Can't have any children.
That's an interesting idea. That's not a bad idea, you know.
You take a marriage test. You go.
Yeah, I mean, major population control issue here.
China, anyone? One child left.
It's true.
Yeah.
Well, interesting, now, of course, this woman twice divorced herself, so I think there might be a little personal agenda going on here, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Megan, as a woman, what do you think on that? I mean, she's obviously, you know, marriage should end after 7 years, but then with the provocative, you know, latex gloves, I don't know what she's trying to play at. You know, a Christian Social Union Party. Yeah. What kind of image are you trying to represent as a politician?
As a political science student, this just seems to be bad strategy.
Bad policy.
Yes.
There's a lot of contradictions here. She's a member of the Conservative Christian Social Union Party, and she's been divorced twice, and she wants expiration dates on marriages. Like, there's just so many problems with this. I don't even know where to begin with this story.
But, I don't know.
What do you think? I mean, it's a plausible idea, I suppose. I mean,
well, I guess, I mean, look at the divorce rates in Canada are nearly 50%, so maybe Polly's onto something. Maybe she knows something we don't, but...
Yeah, could save a lot of money on court costs, I suppose.
We'll see how this pans out in Germany. We'll keep you posted, folks. But all right, that's break time again, and coming up next, it's the Arts Report with Katie Fitzpatrick. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
OMFG, I can't believe it's already that time of the year again.
The time where Mom makes her special pumpkin pie?
No, the time when CITR has their annual fun drive.
Oh, right, sweet. Last year I donated a liver.
I donated my car.
I donated a few dollars.
All donations are helpful and will go towards continuing to run the radio station and all the various different aspects of running such a rad, independent, label-supportive place.
Fun drive will be held from October 1st to the 14th. Call in or walk into the station to donate and know that you were a part of supporting another great year of great music.
CITR.
The Spartacus Youth Club Class Series presents The Fight for Revolutionary Marxism, a series of readings and films presented throughout the fall semester at UBC. The next presentation is...
Mumia Abu-Jamal is an innocent man. Free him now. There is no justice in the capitalist courts.
For class struggle defense to free Mumia, end the racist death penalty.
Video showing, 12 p.m. Tuesday, September 25th, room 212A, Student Union Building, UBC.
For more information, contact the SYC at 604-687-0353 or email trotskyist_Vancouver@shodcable.com.
bcsportsbeat.ca is your source on the internet dedicated to providing you with information on professional and amateur sports in your province. You'll find game scores, team updates, and the perspective of the athletes through in-depth interviews, all at bcsportsbeat.ca. bcsportsbeat.ca, your source for BC sports.
And welcome back to News 101 on CITR. I'm Katie Comley, alongside Jeff Sargent, coming to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Right now it is 5:44 and time to turn things over to Katie Fitzpatrick for a look at the arts.
First up this week, we have the Vancouver International Film Festival. That starts on September 27th and runs till October 12th. At last week's media screenings, I had the chance to check out Outsourced. It's a movie about an American novelty company where every person has their job outsourced to India. The last remaining employee has to leave his hometown of Seattle for Mumbai, where he has to train his replacement. This movie won the Golden Needle Award for audience favorite at the Seattle Film Festival. This could be because part of it takes place in Seattle and people like to see their hometown on the big screen. Nonetheless, it's also a great movie. When you're watching it, you sort of begin as the uneducated person with the Western perspectives about India. But as you watch it, you sort of begin to grow with the main character, learning more and more about India and gaining access to new perspectives. It's definitely a funny movie, and it's definitely cute with a sort of romantic comedy undertone. It's also kind of cheesy at times, though, and it does feature some of those typical film conventions. Nonetheless, it's the type of cheese that manages to create that feel-good feeling, even if you see it for just what it is. Because of this, I would definitely recommend it, though the whole lineup looks great at this year's film festival. You can find information about all the movies at www.viff.org. Outsourced is playing Saturday, October 6th at 3 p.m., and Tuesday, October 9th at 6:40 p.m. at the Empire Granville 7 Theater. I also have a review of Midsummer Night's Dream here at UBC coming up for you in about a minute, but first, this week's arts listings. Beirut. Pikefly Theater presents Alan Brown's one-act tale of forbidden love. That's September 25th to October 7th at Studio 16. Studio 58 presents Dog Eaters, a play based on Jessica Hagedorn's novel about the Philippines during the Marcos dictatorship. That's September 27th to October 14th at Studio 58. The National Ballet of Canada presents the classic ballet Giselle and the contemporary ballet Polyphonia, September 26th to 29th at the Center in Vancouver for the Performing Arts. We're going to have a review of that next week by Tracy Fuller, so make sure you tune in for that. Vancouver New Music presents some cats from Japan. Three performances from Japan's underground electronic art and music scene. That's on September 21st tonight at 8 p.m. at the Scotiabank Dance Center. An 18th Century Affair. Bach, Handel, Haydn, and Mozart. Vancouver Chamber Choir presents its 27th season with a gala festive concert featuring the CBC Radio Orchestra. That's September 22nd at 8 p.m. at the Chan Center for the Performing Arts. We're also going to have a review next week by Colette Johns from the Global Comedy Festival. That's an ongoing 10-day festival featuring performances by Tommy Chong, the Trailer Park Boys, Jeremy Hotz, David Cross, and many more. You can get information about that at VancouverComedyFest.com. The National Association of Japanese Canadians, the National Nikkei Museum and Heritage Center, and the University of Toronto Press present the launch of Race, Racialization, and Anti-Racism in Canada, September 22nd from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the Nikkei Museum in Burnaby. Professor Charles Fisher presents Dismantling Discontent, Buddha's Way Through Darwin's World, on September 25th at 3 p.m. at the Chapters Bookstore at 2505 Granville. It's a book which discusses human nature and meditation from an evolutionary perspective. At the Presentation House Gallery in North Vancouver, they're showing Been Up So Long, It Looks Down to Me, a gallery which we'll have reviewed on October 16th, that's a Tuesday at 2 o'clock, on the half-hour art show. That will be the first episode of that show, and you can tune in at Tuesdays at 2 after that. Here's your promised review of A Midsummer Night's Dream, which I had a chance to check out at the Freddie Wood Theater on Thursday. Now, since A Midsummer Night's Dream is one of the most popular productions of Shakespeare, everyone feels they need to do their own little spin on it. This, of course, happened at the UBC production as well. One thing that they had was gender mixing, so women played men's roles and men played women's roles for the most part. This was definitely interesting. The reason they did it was supposedly to create more challenging roles for everybody, which makes sense. And of course, it also added to that sort of confusion and mixed up nature of A Midsummer Night's Dream. Another unique aspect they had was a futuristic sort of set and really interesting futuristic costume design. They also had some haunting original music by Patrick Pennefather. Despite the strength of the creative team, I would give the cast, which of course features UBC theater students, a mixed review. Sarah Affel created a mesmerizing Puck, and Aslan Hussein made a believable, unique, and interesting Hermia, despite crossing genders to play this female lead. And finally, Kim Harvey, who played Nick Bottom, was hilarious. Some of the characters, the male leads Lysander and Demetrius in particular, fell short, causing the play to drag a bit, especially near the end. Overall, this version of A Midsummer Night's Dream was interesting and entertaining for the most part, and even intriguingly haunting at times. Nonetheless, I find it failed to really stand out amongst the numerous other productions of the famous Shakespearean play. The show was directed by Stephen Heatley and is showing at the Frederick Wood Theatre till September 29th. I'm Katie Fitzpatrick, and that's your Arts Report. Tune in next week for reviews from the Comedy Fest and Giselle and an interview with American poet Rilla Schneiberg.
And thank you very much, Katie. And it's now time for Thunderbird Eye on Sports with Tyler Noble.
All right, thank you, sir. The third-place Thunderbirds football team is in Regina tonight, taking on the Rams in UBC's first road game of the season. The Birds are looking to ride their momentum following last Saturday's thrilling 24-23 come-from-behind second-half victory over the Alberta Golden Bears. The 1-1 Rams, meanwhile, are coming off a bye week after they beat those same Golden Bears 24-22 2 weeks ago. Now, last year when these teams met, it was UBC which came out on top of an offensive explosion, winning 60-48. Despite the Rams' loss, quarterback Teal Orban played well and kept things interesting. Orban is back with the Rams again this year and has once again put up impressive numbers, throwing for 3 touchdowns with a 59% completion rate. Thunderbird starting pivot Doug Goldsby, meanwhile, is coming off an amazing second half last week against Alberta that saw him erase the Birds' 23-point deficit to win the game on a late touchdown run of his own. He also passed for a touchdown and ran a touchdown earlier in the second half. UBC running back Chris Chinsky is currently second in Canada West rushing with 325 yards, but is still looking for a breakout game. Chinsky might be in tough, though, tonight to find many holes against a staunch Rams defense that has held opponents to a conference-leading 151-yard average on the ground. As for playing on the road for the first time this season, Thunderbird head coach Ted Govaya believes the fact that they'll be playing under the lights at Mosaic Stadium will give the boys an emotional lift, hopefully providing a spark coming out of the gates. Kickoff is coming up in about 10 minutes' time, and with a win, the Birds can end the week tied for second place in Canada West football. Moving on to women's soccer, and after starting the season at 3-0, the team will look to preserve their perfect record as they visit the Victoria Vikes tomorrow afternoon in what will be a rematch of last Saturday's 4-1 Thunderbirds victory. Defender Jill Kinsman will likely get the nod in goal once again, filling in for the still-injured Jackie Dunnett. The defending national champion Thunderbirds are currently tied for first place in the Canada West, but have a game in hand on both the Manitoba Bisons and the Trinity Western Spartans. The men's soccer team is hoping to improve upon their disappointing 1-2-1 start as they visit both Alberta and Saskatchewan on a weekend prairie road trip. Coming off a 1-0 loss to the Spartans last Sunday, the Thunderbirds could be in tough facing the second and third place teams in the conference. Last Saturday's 5-0 victory over the Fraser Valley Cascades proves the Birds have the offensive weapons necessary to win, but have struggled to gain a lead in other games so far this year. Rookie midfielder Jorge Engalmira has been a welcome addition to the Birds' offense, sitting 10th in conference scoring, while keeper Nikolai Matney holds the best goals against average in the Canada West at 0.67. UBC head coach Mike Mosier on the big weekend.
You know, I like how we match up against Alberta. Hopefully we'll get a few more bodies back for this weekend as well. I mean, it's a bit of a mash unit, and thus maybe why there's a bit of a inconsistency within our team. Saskatchewan is probably a surprise. You know, they're not a bad side at all. If we put together two good performances like we did on Saturday, then we should be in just fine shape.
Tomorrow's match against the Alberta Golden Bears gets underway at 12:15 p.m. Pacific time, with Sunday's Huskies match starting at 11 a.m. Coming off a 2-game series split against the Pandas in Edmonton last week, the women's field hockey team is set to host the 0-2 Calgary Dinos this weekend at Wright Field. The defending national champion Lady Birds will likely be able to take advantage of a weak Dinos team that has not won a regular season game since 2005. Head coach Hash Kanji on what he expects from his team while playing at home.
I want to put a lot of pressure on teams that come here. I want to play a very attacking style of hockey rather than a defensive style. I want us to show some skills that we've developed over the last couple of years that I think would make it more difficult for teams to contain us when we're in attack.
Calgary remains the only team in the Canada West that has yet to score a goal, and with UBC goalie Katie Graham sporting a 1.0 goals against average, the Dinos will likely continue to struggle. Tomorrow's game begins at 1 p.m. at Wright Field, with Sunday's rematch starting at 1:30. The women's volleyball team suffered a 4-set loss to a visiting university team from Kanoya, Japan, Monday night. The National Institute of Fitness and Sport had trained with the Ladybirds for several weeks in what UBC head coach Doug Reimer says was a tremendous experience for his squad. Reimer says the level of intensity with which the Japanese team played will be very helpful as the women's Thunderbirds team moves into Canada West competition. Liz Cordonnier will be back this year starting for the Ladybirds, while much of the starting squad is yet to be determined. There are several newcomers looking for a roster spot, including national team trainees Natalie Eads and Jen Hines. The Birds now have just over a month before conference play begins on October 24th at home against the Simon Fraser Clan. In men's hockey, the team is back in exhibition action this weekend as they play a two-game series against the Lethbridge Pronghorns at the newly renovated UBC Winter Sports Center. The Birds will be looking to improve upon last weekend's series against the Golden Bears in Banff, which left UBC with a tie and a loss. Hopes are high for this year's team after the Thunderbirds won their first playoff series in 36 years last season. Head coach Milan Dragicevic is now in his sixth year behind the bench and says the goal is to host a playoff series and with any luck make it to the Nationals, which will be held at the University of Moncton in March. Key returning players for UBC include fourth-year All-Star defenseman Brad Zanin, third-year center Daryl May, and former Vancouver Giant winger Mitch Bartley. Dragicevic says overall his team is ahead of where they were last year, but the biggest challenge will be to create more offensive chances, especially on the power play. The Birds open regular season play on October 5th against Alberta, a game that we'll have here for you on CITR. Puck drop for tonight's game against Lethbridge is just moments away at 6 o'clock. And finally, the women's hockey team is also in preseason action tonight as they host the BC Breakers at the Winter Sports Center immediately following the men's game. Last season, the Lady Birds fell to the eventual national champion Alberta Pandas in the Canada West semifinals. Coach Dave Newson's young team now has a bit more experience to draw upon, with many players returning from last year's squad, including goaltender Melinda Choi, who garnered Canada West Rookie of the Year honors. Tonight's game begins at about 8:30 p.m. at the Winter Sports Center, again immediately following the men's game, with tomorrow's match against the Vancouver Fusion starting at 6 o'clock. And Katie, that's all for Thunderbird Eye on Sports.
Thank you very much, Tyler. And before we go tonight, we're going to check in with our meteorologist, Cindy Yu, for your weekend weather. And she's back in Vancouver. Cindy? Oh, sorry. It looks like we're having a little bit of technical difficulties, but we'll get Cindy Yu on the line very soon. Sorry, we're just going to cut to PSA break, but we'll have your weekend weather right after this.
Student featured UBC TV. Check out www.ubctv.ca. Originally conceived in 1990, UBC TV reinvented itself this past year with the launch of www.ubctv.ca. With support from UBC Rec and run by and for students, the site showcases student material ranging from films and music videos to sports, including the production of its own show, UBC Sports Desk. With the goal of getting students involved, UBC TV allows students to submit their content. Viewers have the added advantage of video on demand, allowing them to choose with ease exactly what they want to watch and when. UBC TV is recruiting staff for the next school year. Positions available are IT Director, Marketing Director, Program Director, Producer, Videographer, and Marketing Assistant. Anyone interested is requested to send an email to info@ubctv.ca or to log on to ubctv.ca for more details.
I want to be on your TV so that you...
And we apologize for that technical mishap, but we are back, and here is Cindy Yu back home in Vancouver with your weekend weather. Cindy?
Thanks, Katie. I don't think the phone liked me very much today. But can you feel the fall on the way? It was chilly today, and the rain was definitely setting the mood. Fall is indeed coming. Tomorrow will be the last day of summer, and then Sunday morning at exactly 2:52, that's the official arrival of fall. Of course, it's been a pretty rainy day today for the most part. We will talk about the rain. The normal rainfall for Vancouver in September is about 54 millimeter. Of course, this year so far, we have received about 10.6 of millimeter of rain thanks to the beautiful weather for the first half of the month. So, well, you know, do expect some rainfall for the second half, of course. Here are some numbers for you. Currently, it is 12 degrees at the Vancouver airport with light rain. The good news is that we are expecting periods of rain ending for the overnight period. It will be windy after the front pass And, of course, with your low hanging around 12 degrees, so it's not going to drop your temperature very much. Saturday, still cloudy, but there will be some sunny periods in between. There is, however, a 60% chance of showers. In the afternoon, your high will be 16 degrees. Saturday night, cloudy periods with a low of 9. Sunday will be a good day with a mix of sun and cloud, and your high, well, will only be 15 degrees. And, of course, Monday, another cold front passes with a 40% chance of showers for the day, a low of 10 and a high of 14. Definitely have your umbrella handy this weekend. It may not be as bad as today, but it's always good. It's always good to be prepared, I think. I'm Cindy Yu, and that was your CITR weather forecast. Back to you, Katie.
Thanks very much, Cindy, for that lovely weekend weather forecast, even if it is rainy. But I guess that concludes our show.
Yes, that is our program for today, September 21st, 2007. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to get in contact with us, give us a few comments. You can phone us at 604-822-5334 or email news at citr.ca.
Megan Turcotto produced this radio program.
For more news, join us Monday at 5 p.m. for the next edition of News 101. For the entire news team here at CITR, I'm Katie Comley.
And I'm Jeff Sargent. Thank you very much for listening. Coming up next is The Canadian Way. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.